Welcome to our podcast, Psychiatric Services, From Pages to Practice. In this podcast, we highlight new research or columns published this month in the journal Psychiatric Services. I'm Lisa Dixon, editor of Psychiatric Services, and I'm here with podcast editor and my co-host, Dr. Josh Berezin. Hi, Josh.
Hi, Lisa.
Today, we're going to talk about three articles from the journal that have been published recently online. We'll look at the dollars and cents behind a collaborative care intervention for perinatal depression. We'll discover how people experience involuntary admission to psychiatric hospitals, and also see how the use of psychotherapy relates to polypharmacy.
Sounds good. Let's start with Nancy Grote's study on the incremental benefit cost of mom care, collaborative care for perinatal depression among economically disadvantaged women. Collaborative care has obviously become a big part of the behavioral health landscape, and it seems like there's tons of studies about it. So what sets this one apart?
Before we start talking about the study, I just want to mention that the senior author on this paper is Dr. Wayne Caton. Wayne is a giant in our field. He tested, really developed, and was a part of testing and disseminating collaborative care as a critical intervention to help people with depression and anxiety and other mental illnesses who present in primary care. And so I want to acknowledge his contribution, which, you know, Wayne's work just keeps reappearing and he will never be forgotten. So this paper is important for a number of reasons. It focuses on perinatal depression, which I think we all know has huge health consequences, huge public health consequences, and individual health consequences for the mother and the child. And also the study delivers this intervention in a socioeconomically disadvantaged group of women with various races, diverse races and ethnicities. And importantly, it follows women for 18 months from middle of pregnancy through 15 months out. So it really is very longitudinal and allows us to assess the relative impact of collaborative care across a sustained time frame.
So other studies have given us more of a snapshot, and this is giving us like a hopeful year and a half of experience from mid-pregnancy all the way out.
Exactly.
You also brought up the population that that the study is studying, and I think that that's really important. They mentioned in their background that this population is twice as likely to have major depression during pregnancy. I mean, that's like one of those statistics that you can just sort of skim over as you're reading through the background. But when you stop and think of it, twice as likely to have major depression, that's pretty startling.
Yeah. And having been pregnant and having two children myself, the notion of experiencing major depression during that time frame is really daunting and chilling. And so it's just so important. The study is so important. So what did the study do? It compared collaborative care that they called mom care for these women. And again, I think most of us are familiar with collaborative care at this point, but it's a systematic approach, as the authors talk about, for reducing depression severity that includes evidence-based depression treatment. For example, a choice of psychotherapy or pharmacotherapy, and active sustained measurement of outcomes and follow-up according to stepped care principles. So this notion of stepped care and identifying and following them to the extent possible within the primary care setting, or in this case, the OBGYN setting. And then the comparison condition is usual care plus.
Yeah, so the usual care, it seems like, is basically case management plus referral out for women who are experiencing depression. That's usual care within the area that they're working in. And then the plus was that if people had a PHQ-9 of, I think it was above a 10, then they would get sort of more intensive services.
Right. And so the control condition was pretty strong in my view. As you mentioned, it has includes case management, but it's also being served by a multidisciplinary team of social workers, nurses, and nutritionists, again, who offer case management and facilitate contact with the obstetrician, to help the women get what they need.
So this is not just a study about outcomes. This is also about cost.
Yeah. So that's another unique aspect of the study, is that they started out with the idea of doing a cost-benefit analysis. And so as best I understood it, they were looking at the difference in cost between the two conditions and looking at how that difference in cost mapped to the valuation of the outcome. So their outcome was
depression-free days.
Exactly. And so then we have to think about, well, how much is a depression-free day worth?
Right. And how do you figure that? How do you figure that out? A depression-free day would be worth a lot of money to me if I had major depression. I would pay a good chunk of change to have a day without depression.
So would I.
Yeah. But, you know, the number crunchers apparently in the literature have put a $15 to $25 range on a depression-free day.
We would, when we think about how it feels to be depressed, $20 doesn't even come close, in my view. But in any case, how did that work in the study? So what did they find? So one thing that they did prospectively was they anticipated that PTSD might be an important moderator of the impact of this intervention on women with depression.
So a lot of moving parts in the study.
A lot of moving parts.
Let me see if I've got everything straight. Basically, in both groups, with women with PTSD and with women without PTSD, the mom care, the intervention that they're studying, cost about $1,200 more, give or take.
Exactly.
More or less. But in women with PTSD, they had a lot more depression-free days than when you're just looking at women with
right.
depression.
68 to 13.
Okay. So basically, one way of thinking about this is, would it really be worth it doing this more expensive intervention in a group that you're not going to get very much bang for your buck? You're not really going to get very many more depression-free days. Maybe not. But with the women who are with PTSD, you're getting a lot for that money that you're spending.
Exactly.
And then their question is, how do you figure out if it's worth it or not?
Exactly. And so this is where the valuation of a depression-free day comes in. So if we say that a depression-free day is worth $20, which, again, we've already talked about the fact that we think it's probably worth way more than that. But in any event, if, as consistent with the literature, if we say that it's $20, well, actually, turns out mom care has a good cost-benefit outcome for women with major depression and probable PTSD. And if you value your depression-free day at $20 or more, you really have a good deal. And the mom care costs a little bit more, but you get all that back in the value of the outcome and possibly more. Not so much for the women without PTSD.
One of the analogies that they used at the end that I found very helpful was that essentially, if you do the math for women with PTSD, mom care gives them basically 2 months of days without depression for $2.50 a day. So clearly that would be, well, to me, that would be worth it.
I think that this was a terrific study and one that really pushes the envelope. It pulls in all the important things we need for science and policy.
Mm-hmm.
We want to have good science, we want to have outcomes, and we want to have value.
The trifecta. Next up, we have Rebecca Murphy's article on service users' experiences of involuntary hospital admission under the Mental Health Act of 2001 in the Republic of Ireland. This is a qualitative study with the results of interviews of 50 people who'd been admitted against their will to an inpatient psychiatric unit.
Yeah, and I thought this was a really interesting study. There have been other studies of the consumer or patient's experience of involuntary hospitalization, but what I thought was unique about this study is that they are not just looking at kind of responses to specific events like IM medications or seclusion and restraint, but they're looking at the entire experience of the commitment so that the person had the time to kind of process it. So not right in the middle, but also not too far away.
So it gives people a chance to reflect on the entire experience, and they're not sort of in the throes of a psychiatric illness. They're out of the hospital, and they've had a chance to think about things. I thought that the real heart of the paper were these quotes from the participants. They're just very bracing to me. You know, they talk about feeling ambushed in their homes, feeling confused and just completely powerless, losing dignity, and then after the hospitalization, having flashbacks and not being able to integrate their experiences.
Yeah, that is the power of qualitative research, is the authenticity of the words that come from the individuals and their experience. And I think it's just taking a minute to read through, they have a couple of tables of quotes, I think is very touching and painful, actually, as a provider.
Yeah, you also have to kind of let them sink in, because they're the sorts of things that I've heard from people, but it's very easy when you're doing your job to say, okay, I've got to ignore that and do the work that I'm doing. But if you really sit down and listen to these, they're very painful experiences that people are having.
Yeah, it makes it real and it makes it human. And just to reflect a little bit more on what they found, it's not a surprise. It's not a surprise that people would experience involuntary admissions in, at least to some extent, in a negative manner. But what can we learn from this? If we go beneath the surface of their findings, for me, I said to myself, well, there are some lessons here. There are even simple lessons and ways that these data teach us how we can do better. And I wanted to focus on two of the themes. One was lack of emotional and informational support, and the positive person-centered encounters. And what I got from that, from those two themes, was that it is really possible for an individual provider or nurse or mental health technician or doctor or even security guard, anybody participating in this process, to make a difference by saying something that is supportive or acknowledges the person's experience, by educating, by validating, and taking what is really a situation that none of us wants to be in. No person with mental illness wants to be in this situation, and no provider really wants to be in this situation. And it gives us a roadmap to being, you know, to at least minimizing the pain of this.
Right. One of the questions that the whole study brought up for me was, what sorts of things lead to those interactions? Is it just that you have these very special people who are saints who know the right thing to say at the right time? Or is it something about the patient that's going on and where they are in their process? Or hopefully, is there something that we can do in the system to make these interactions that you're talking about more frequent, whether that's training individuals or changing the way that people are admitted? Or
yeah, so we don't have to leave this to chance, and we shouldn't leave it to chance.
Because
right?
We're going to screw it up.
Right. And, you know, the authors themselves provide a really helpful list of steps that should be taken based on what their data found, you know, that we need to provide knowledge and training to professionals in how to work in these kinds of situations, to choose respectful dialogue, and I'm just taking from their words, and choice when possible, to openly acknowledge and discuss the person's experience. And there is no reason why we can't build that sort of response and those management tools. There's no reason why we can't make that the standard.
What do you think has stopped us from making that the standard up until now?
Oh, I can't speculate. I think what I would say in answer, to sort of not answer your question and answer it, is that what we are learning to do is to pay attention to the voices of people who have been the recipients of our services. And when we listen to them, we learn. And if we're smart about what we learn, we apply it. Many people, of course, think there should be no involuntary treatment, there should be no involuntary hospitalizations, and that's not what I think we want to debate here. That's really a whole other topic. But if we listen to consumers, there's no question that we can learn how to make this process less likely to produce PTSD.
Yeah. So that's why these qualitative studies are really invaluable to our work.
I thought that when we were talking earlier, you mentioned how you would love to have residents or trainees read this paper and read the quotes and read about the experiences. And maybe we should even just set up sessions with trainees to have trainees talk to individuals who've been through an involuntary experience.
Absolutely. This should be required reading for trainees, because things, I'm recently out of training and things are just moving so quickly, and you've got a job to do and you don't have any time to step back and reflect. And I think, I was talking about asking what sorts of things we can do to improve the system and make those person-centered encounters more likely. I think one of them is to face the painful fact that we're sometimes doing something that's going to lead to more symptoms in the future that's not therapeutic. And even that, if you can take a second to reflect on how you're interacting with somebody, maybe sometimes it's unavoidable that this is going to be a traumatic experience, but maybe it's not. Maybe just sort of...
Maybe it is avoidable.
Yeah, maybe it's avoidable, and we can do better. And to wrap things up, we have Juan Hincapie Castillo's study on the prevalence of psychotherapy surrounding initiation of psychotropic polypharmacy in the Medicaid-insured population, 1999 to 2010.
That is a mouthful.
Yeah, you guys don't really skimp on the titles
in psych services. Well, it's a very descriptive title.
It is, yes. I know exactly what I'm in for. So what they're looking at is the extent to which a sample of Medicaid patients who get polypharmacy also get psychotherapy. This is a good question. Adding psychotherapy is evidence-based, and you'd hope that when you're adding medication, the provider would step back and say, okay, well, what other modalities do I need to add at this point?
Right. So specifically, they're asking, at the point in time when a patient goes from essentially monotherapy, pharmacologically speaking, to polypharmacy, pharmacologically speaking, is there any evidence from claims that a psychotherapeutic element or a psychotherapy has been added?
Yes, and they're looking in a window. They're looking 6 months before initiation of polypharmacy and then 6 months after initiation of polypharmacy.
Right. And so you would expect, or you would hope, that as a doctor or a nurse practitioner or a PA who is prescribing another medication, more than one, should we be thinking, should we add a psychotherapy, an evidence-based psychotherapy, as opposed to or in addition to adding a medication?
Right. So we don't know if that's actually happening or not. So what the authors did is they looked at claims data from, like you mentioned, from 29 states over a 10-year period. This is both kids and adults.
Mm-hmm. And I also, again, wanted to mention that this is a Medicaid sample, so this only applies. We don't know if it applies beyond the Medicaid cohorts that they looked at. So again, we're looking at different cohorts from 1999 to 2001, 2000 to 2002, all the way up to 2008 to 2010. So these three-year cohorts. And basically, here's the pattern. The rate of psychotherapy started anywhere from, say, 20% in the first cohort to close to 40% in one of the middle cohorts. And then it went up just a little bit in the period of time when polypharmacy was being delivered. So for example, the 20% went up to about 25%, the 40% went up to about 45%, so that there was a very modest, very, very modest increase in the amount of psychotherapy delivered at this critical time point. Now, for adults, the rate of psychotherapy being delivered was actually quite a bit lower, and the increment was also minimal. So, for example, in 1999 to 2001, for adults, They started out with about 10% of patients receiving psychotherapy, and that went up to somewhere around 13%. But with adults, the overall rate of psychotherapy was quite a bit lower, and the bump was also very, very in some kids.
So at best,
yeah,
at when whatever time it was, when the providers were doing the best, less than 1/5 of adults were getting psychotherapy when they were prescribed polypharmacy, and less than 1/2 of kids were.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Okay, and so these are concerning.
Yeah, you'd expect in practice for the clinician to be thinking broadly about what to do when someone is not necessarily responding to a medication. And of course, you know, these are claims. We don't know what people were thinking. We can't be 100% sure that the delivery of a psychotherapy would have been reflected in a new claim for psychotherapy. So there's a lot of concerns and challenges with interpreting these kind of data. But again, it's really quite consistent for literally almost each time point for adults and kids. And so I think the big picture is something that we probably need to address.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, one of the big questions is, why is this happening? So the authors put forth a hypothesis that it's a combination of a shortage of psychiatrists plus a lack of psychiatrists to actually take Medicaid, which has pushed primary care physicians into doing most of the prescribing role, and they don't really have the experience to manage psychotherapy. So, I mean, like, that makes sense to me, but I also think about some of the larger forces, like psychotherapy training and residency, which is sort of like the culture of psychiatry in general, and also Medicaid reimbursement. I think I heard what the Medicaid reimbursement rate was for just like a psychopharmacology visit, and it was low. I don't remember what the exact number was, but I couldn't imagine that a clinic could sort of stay above water almost with the reimbursement rates for that. So, you know, I also wonder if there's an argument here for psychiatrists themselves to be delivering more psychotherapy.
You know, that's all possible. And I think, you know, you throw into this whole mix the obligation that we have to work with patients and offer choice. You know, some people prefer psychotherapy, some people prefer medications. And I think that the big picture here is that if we go back to, you know, collaborative care and measurement-based care, that we should be working with our patients, tracking their status, their symptoms, their response, their preferences, their experience of treatment, and over time really pulling them into a discussion of what to do when something's not working, what to do when something is working, for how long do we maintain treatment. And I mean, obviously, this is all ideal. I think the study is important because it provides us with an empirical challenge that we have to try to meet. And the nice thing about this kind of study is that we can go back and measure this again. We can do something. We can make a change. Mm-hmm. We can address the problem or try to address the problem and see if it works.
It also starts to give clinics and providers just some broad sense of a baseline of what they might be shooting for in terms of their rates of psychotherapy when they're not just sort of saying, well, we should have 80% or 30%, and it kind of gives you a little bit of a baseline.
And I think that obviously before you, another step would be to try to understand in more detail the extent to which the claims are being used to reflect the delivery of psychotherapy. So we really want to dig into that. And if it's not reflecting the delivery of psychotherapy, we want to have a way of tracking and measuring care so that we can ask the question about the delivery of psychotherapy within psychopharmacologic polypharmacy more effectively. So that concludes our second edition of our podcast. We invite you to visit our website, ps.psychiatryonline.org, to read the articles we discussed in this episode, as well as other great research. We also welcome your feedback. Please email us at psjournal@psych.org. I'm Lisa Dixon.
And I'm Josh Berzin.
Until next time.